Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Independence Day, the 4th of July. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So we'll talk about the pursuit of happiness, which will figure in to this hour of all things political. Craig Gilbert is our guest, Washington Bureau Chief of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. As you well know, the Senate has canceled its 4th of July recess to remain in session during debt limit talks. Republicans and Democrats are at a complete impasse over how to cut the deficit, which Republicans say has to happen before they'll agree to the nation's $14.3 trillion debt limit before an August 2nd deadline. Republicans want large spending cuts and no tax increases. Democrats saying higher tax revenue must be a part of a balanced plan. And there is an impasse on that. Minnesota has experienced a government shutdown. We're going to try and do a whole show on that tomorrow. But there's no budget deal in sight there. We'll look at that state. Recall elections, of course, approaching soon in the state of Wisconsin. Is there likely to be a shift in power in the Wisconsin Senate, or does that seem unlikely? And what would it mean for the future of the state? Those are just a couple of issues that are on my mind. Hour number two today, we're going to be speaking. We should have a really good conversation about the Civil War. The chair of the Wisconsin Civil War Sesquicentennial Commission will be with us the second hour of our program. He is the author of a number of books, including most recently Those Black Hats, the Iron Brigade in the Gettysburg Campaign. So we'll look specifically at Wisconsin soldiers and families who supported Civil War soldiers on the battlefield and also on the home front. You're welcome to join our 4th of July conversation as we talk about the pursuit of happiness this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Chrissy Peace is in the house this morning answering your phone calls. So let's celebrate the 4th of July. Craig Gilbert, happy 4th of July.
Good morning.
Are you spending the day in the pursuit of happiness?
I will go and see the fireworks in our nation's capital.
Oh, how are those? Is that a big deal?
They're pretty good. You see seeing them against the backdrop of the monuments, it's pretty cool.
I'll bet it is. That would be a good place to be on the 4th of July. I was driving up from Illinois yesterday, though, and there were fireworks all over. It's funny how traditions are just really important on this day.
It's also one of the most heavily secured 4th of July sites you can imagine. Lots of security, the monuments are the only reminder that you're in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I'm sure. So is the Senate off today and they're back tomorrow, or what's the story?
Well, they were gone, they're gone as per normal over the weekend, and
right,
then they should be coming back Tuesday. I mean, that decision was as much symbolic as anything else, because obviously the negotiations are taking place at the leadership level, not involving rank-and-file members of Congress. So it was really a matter of the leaders of the Senate thinking it would look bad if they went on their recess with this deadline pending.
So do you think in order to deal with the deficit, you have to have what the Republicans want, large spending cuts, and what the Democrats want, tax increases?
Well, there's the fiscal question, and then there's the political question. And, the fiscal answer is whatever, it doesn't really matter in a purely mathematical sense where it comes from, what proportion is spending cuts or revenue increases, as they say, as long as the dollars add up to a certain amount. But politically, it gets more difficult to see where the common ground is, because Republicans have ruled out tax increases. Now, the question is, what exactly does that mean? Does that mean that they would rule out closing tax breaks or tax loopholes to raise revenue? And there appears to be some wiggle room there. But then, some Republicans have said they would go along with that, but they won't go along with any net increase in taxes. So, in other words, that suggests that they might agree, to a cutting a corporate tax subsidy, but not if it's not offset by a tax cut elsewhere. So it's just hard to see when, given the position that Republicans have taken, where they get the votes on the Democratic side, particularly in the House, because they're going to need some, there are going to be Republicans who are going to vote against the debt ceiling increase regardless. They're going to need some Democratic votes. The question is, where do they get the Democratic votes, and what does the package have to look like? What does it have to include to get some Democratic support in the House?
The president last week said, before we ask our seniors to pay more for health care, before we cut our children's education, it's only fair to ask an oil company or corporate jet owner that's done so well to give up that tax break that no other business enjoys. Would there be Republican support for that?
I think there might be some Republican support again for closing some so-called tax loopholes or tax subsidies. But again, the question is the context. I'm not sure the Republican leadership would support doing that if it resulted in a net increase in taxes. So they may demand that closing a corporate tax break here requires an offsetting tax reduction there. That's the question. So I don't know the answer to that, and that's why this is such a difficult issue. There are differences among Republicans and among conservatives over what constitutes a tax increase, and we've seen people like Tom Coburn, the pretty independent conservative senator from Oklahoma, get into battles with the famous Grover Norquist, enforcer of the litmus test on taxes among Republicans, where the Norquist position is that any closing of a tax loophole is a tax increase unless it's offset somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there is a chance that the nation's debt limit will not be raised before August 2nd?
I think there's a chance.
Do you really?
I think there's a chance that on the first pass they'll miss the deadline. I mean, that's certainly a possibility. I don't think there's a chance for a super protracted impasse, because I just think that the stakes are too high, and especially if the markets start to react in a really bad way. I mean, part of the debate we've been hearing has been over how, you know, cataclysmic and catastrophic missing the deadline would be, and that's why, I mean, the Republicans are playing. I mean, the strategy they're pursuing is they're doing this because they see this. They see that this is an opportunity for leverage. Even though we have divided government, this is their best shot in the foreseeable future at exercising some leverage to try to get major budget concessions. And the reason they have leverage is because everybody's afraid of what happens if they don't raise the debt ceiling. By the same token, there are risks for Republicans for the very same reason, if they're seen as the culprits in an impasse. But we've had Republicans like Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, who's been very vocal in arguing that the fallout, the negative consequences of failure to meet that deadline are not as bad as people like Ben Bernanke has been saying, as many independent experts and many Democrats have been saying. So that's part of the debate, is over how bad an outcome and how terrible it would be in this scenario if we miss the deadline.
Mm-hmm. And Craig, what do you think? You've got a handle on what the public is thinking about this. Do you think that everybody's really concerned about the debt ceiling, or are they more concerned about jobs?
Well, I think it is both. I mean, I do think that the debt and spending are powerful political issues. We certainly saw that in 2010. So I don't think they're vastly overrated as political issues. I do think, obviously, the history of these issues is that jobs is more important, and that it matters more to people, and certainly it matters more to the fate of politicians in office, that the economy grows, that we have job growth, than what's the deficit. But we're going to see a test of this question, because, again, the Republican Party is making the argument. I mean, most of their agenda right now is based on the proposition that we are in danger at some point down the road of experiencing a catastrophic debt crisis. And politically, that they understand that they need to persuade people of that fact in order to build political support for the kinds of spending cuts that they're asking for, because everybody knows those spending cuts are painful. So this will be, 2012 will certainly be a test of that proposition in part. It will also be, as everybody knows, it will depend heavily on how the economy is doing and what the job trends are in the rest of this year and in 2012.
Let's spend just a moment. We'll do a full hour on this tomorrow on our neighboring state, Minnesota, into their third day with no functioning state government. And it's, classic division here again. The Democratic governor wanting to raise income taxes on the wealthiest people in the state. Republicans who control the House and the Senate say no deal on that. In the meantime, people who live in Minnesota are going to be getting pretty mad, don't you think?
Sure. And I mean, I saw one quote from a Republican legislator who was worried about the political consequences because he noted that some members of the legislature are going to come up for election before the governor has to. The governor won't have to come up for re-election for another 3 years. So there's a difference. I mean, that's one sort of political note about Minnesota. I mean, you never know exactly how people are going to react to these situations. We had the situation, obviously, the government shutdown, quote unquote, in 1995, in which Republicans lost that argument. So there is some kind of latent anxiety among Republicans about having that happen again. On the other hand, there's also all this sentiment and energy within the Republican Party and among the class of 2010 in Congress to press ahead, regardless of those kinds of political fears, and force the issue.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, if you close my swimming hole on the 4th of July, I'm going to be kind of upset.
Yeah, well, there's no question people will be upset. The question is, who are they going to take it out on?
Right. We welcome phone calls. Craig Gilbert is our guest for all things political this 4th of July. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. And we'll start our calls with Boyd from Milwaukee. Hi, Boyd.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Greg. Good morning.
Good morning.
4th of July to both of you.
To you as well.
Thank you. Greg, I did read your article yesterday on Ron Johnson, and personally, it's the first time I really heard anything from him since he was in office. He seems to be in the doghouse with people on the left because of this $10 million that he received. I don't know too much about it. I was wondering if, A, you could elaborate on that, and do you think that, though, over the long term, he is going to make some sort of impact, or do you think his rhetoric will catch up with him? I'll admit, his politics aren't mine, but I guess at this point you sort of have to give him the benefit of the doubt. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks, Boyd.
Everyone.
Yep. Well, the $10 million refers to a cash deferred compensation he took from his own company after the campaign. And we've written about this in some detail in our paper. I didn't address it in my story yesterday, but he funded his own campaign, put a lot of money into his own campaign, and then after the campaign, he did take deferred compensation in an amount that wasn't, that was sort of in the ballpark of what he's personally spent on the campaign. So the accusation is that this was kind of an end run around the election laws, and that's the kind of issue that if it prompts a complaint, would have to be evaluated by the FEC. I don't know where that goes, and it has been raised, and it is being debated, and it's out there. On the broader question, what's the future for Ron Johnson? I mean, the biggest question I get about Ron Johnson from people in the political world back in Wisconsin is, does he really want to be a senator? And how long is he going to want to be a senator 5 years from now, given his background? People sort of ask the same question about Herb Kohl early in his career. He is kind of there's a fish out of water quality here because he's not, doesn't have a political background. You're talking about a guy, an executive who's used to, being able to call his own shots, and here you are in this parliamentary body, and in fact, in his case, in the minority. So limited power, certainly the ability as an individual senator to kind of gum up the works procedurally, as all senators have, and which we've begun to see. But I don't know. I mean, I think it's kind of unpredictable. It'll be really interesting to watch kind of how he takes to the job, whether he can have any impact. There really is your impact is limited as an individual senator, certainly an individual senator in the minority. The Republicans hope to take the majority in 2012, but we don't know whether that's going to happen or not. And so we'll see. I mean, he is, what sort of stands out about him to me is just how single-minded his focus is in coming to the Senate on this one set of issues. I'm used to watching senators who are, you know, they've got this issue, foreign policy issue that they work on or are interested in. They've got a whole basket of different domestic issues that they work on. And obviously that will happen to some degree with him, but he is so focused on debt spending, deficits, regulation, on this kind of basket of issues that he ran on, that's all he really wants to talk about, and that's really what he cares about. And so that makes him, in my mind, kind of unusual. It's certainly maybe a little bit less unusual in the context of the Republican Party today, which is running on these issues. So, but I think it'll be interesting to watch, given his background and given his policy focus, you know, how he evolves as a senator. It'll be interesting to watch how he evolves on some of these issues like foreign policy that didn't get a lot of attention during the campaign. But in terms of his core issues, those domestic issues, we kind of know. I mean, he is what he is, and we know where he's coming from, and he's the guy that, he's what we saw during the campaign.
You write in the article, everybody's in a state of denial right now. This is quoting Johnson. Said Johnson, with a mix of urgency and exasperation, we really are on the brink. People don't talk about it. People don't listen. We're human beings. We're living our lives. We don't want to hear bad news. Expand on that. What does he see as the brink?
He truly believes that we're on the precipice of a fiscal disaster. And that's, again, a perception, a mindset, a worldview that is driving for some Republicans, this debate. It's sort of driving the kind of line drawing that's going on. It's driving the rhetoric. It's, in other words, they're in this almost crisis mindset, and they see they have a sense of mission, and their mission is we are trying to avert a calamity that would be destructive and disastrous to our country, and this is why we're willing to go to these lengths and go to the mat on these issues, because they see the country on a trajectory for fiscal ruin, and not just in 40 years or 30 years, but they see it as being much more urgent than that. Now, of course, none of us can answer these questions in terms of, we can all see a chart and see the trajectory of spending and see that, you know, we have some unsustainable fiscal trends, but nobody knows whether without major changes, whether there'd be a so-called debt crisis and when it would happen. So it's a hard argument to kind of settle to anybody's satisfaction, but that's the perception on the part of Ron Johnson and like-minded fiscal hawks, is that that's the boat we're in, and that really colors their voting behavior and their rhetoric and their approach to these problems.
Craig Gilbert is our guest for All Things Political on this 4th of July. He's Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and we have some lines open. We also have an email address in case you can't phone us today. That is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program this 4th of July, historian and author Lance Hertigan will be with us, chair of the Wisconsin Civil War Sesquicentennial Commission. He is a noted Civil War historian and is author of a number of books, including Those Black Hats, The Iron Brigade in the Gettysburg Campaign. Marty in Douglas County is your next caller, Craig. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good morning, you guys. It looks like the Republicans, both, let's just take Minnesota and then nationally, are setting up something that they often flail their hands and squeal about. Class warfare. Well, the state of Minnesota is being was closed on behalf of 0.3% of their population. 7,500 wealthy Minnesotans have closed down the state of Minnesota at least the Republicans there have closed it on their behalf. And then nationally, the debt ceiling, oh, my God, if we raise taxes on gajillionaires, the country is going to fall apart because then these wealthy people won't want to create jobs and open companies. Well, let's, for the last 30 years, we've been hearing that. And look at the unemployment. Look at where we are right now. Why are Republicans putting their, I don't know, putting the country, I guess, on the line on behalf of people with great gobs of money?
Craig.
Well, all I can tell you is it has become an article of faith within the Republican Party, and this is something that's happened over a period of, you know, a few decades, I would say, to oppose categorical opposition to tax increases. And there's a lot of reasons for that. There's a history there. George Bush Sr., read my lips. Then he goes back on his pledge, and he's Republican opponents of tax increases have, you know, basically achieved a kind of a consensus, a virtual consensus within their party on this issue, and that's why you see kind of Republicans in lockstep on this position. So that's, like I said, it's a pretty categorical position that includes raising marginal rates at the upper tiers of the income scale. And, you know, there are some issues, like we've talked about, where there appears to be some gray area over what constitutes a tax increase. But anything that smacks of increasing tax rates is something that is not being entertained within the Republican Party right now. And so kind of that's where we're at. And then the other ingredient here, of course, is because of the need to raise the debt ceiling, it kind of gives Republicans sudden leverage on this issue, whereas in the past, it's kind of been deferred as it was in the deal last year. So, I mean, if you want a better explanation than that, I think you'll have to talk to people in the Republican Party and leadership of the Republican Party. But this is kind of where the party is at in this day and age.
On the other hand, you have shockingly high unemployment. You have people who are not getting raises, whose benefits are being cut. You've got unemployment rates among teenagers this summer at huge highs. One quarter of all teens, it's important for a teen to have a summer job, 40% of African Americans. A couple questions here. People are concerned about that. They're concerned about their economic well-being and being able to find jobs. Why isn't that issue addressed? Why have the Democrats been front and center about that issue, and the Republicans as well, who have been able to define what the national discourse is as being about the deficit and the debt ceiling, when simultaneously people are out of work and they're hurting?
Well, the real problem is you have two completely different theories about how to generate job growth. And so I think the Republicans we're talking about would argue, or do argue, that they're not just concerned about deficits, that that debt and deficits are choking economic growth. I'm saying this is the argument.
Right.
And the argument is that if we don't come up with a debt ceiling deal that takes a huge whack at long-term spending, then that's going to do economic harm, and that's going to limit job growth because the markets are going to shrink back in horror. And that then that will lead to a spike and a long-term rise in interest rates, which will choke off investment, which will hurt jobs. So we've got two completely different theories about economic growth. We've got the sort of, you know, so the notion that stimulus, you know, short-term, long-term deficit reduction, but balance it with short-term stimulus is kind of scoffed at largely by Republicans. And so this is what makes it difficult to arrive at policy deals when you have different economic theories at work.
Yeah. Thanks, Marty, very much for your call. We go to Mark in Brookfield next. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Happy 4th.
Happy 4th to you. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Say, you know, I just want to kind of weigh in on what's been really grinding my beans lately about a lot of this talk, and it can all be summed up into just a few things here. And it basically goes down to the future of our energy is the future of the global economy. You know, we got to get off the fossil fuels, go right to all the sustainable and green issues that can really put a lot of people back to work. And the problem is they're not drawing the lines between helping the environment, going green, and putting so many people back to work. Now, politicians and guys like Ron Johnson that are climate change deniers are already in the pockets of the interests of the gas and oil people, and they'll never come around and start making decisions that will not only help the environment, but will put so many people back to work. You know, why are we still using 19th century energy choices like, you know, like gas, and we moved away from steam and the telegraph and the Pony Express and the Clipper ship and whale oil because it was cost effective to move away and everybody benefited. But the fossil fuel industry has their hands on the grip, you know, a grip on the steering wheel, and they're taking us all down with them until it's all used up and burnt up and we're all coughing and gagging and sputtering and, you know, sitting there in an ashtray we used to call our neighborhood. You know, why can't they draw the line between the possibilities, the endless possibilities of job creation and stuff like that by going green and move away from the fossil fuels?
Craig.
Well, Democrats have tried to make that argument. I mean, Obama's tried to make that argument or has made that argument. Bill Clinton made that argument. So it's not like it's been missing from the message, the Democratic message. I mean, it is a big debate, obviously, big political debate and big policy fight. It's going to get bigger with this sort of looming battle or ongoing battle over shale and hydrofracking, which is a kind of a new way of extracting natural gas, and so it's a pretty ripe issue, and we're going to have a lot more collisions ahead at the state level, at the federal level, over fossil fuels as well as over alternative energies. So it is a real dividing line between the parties, and I don't think it's been neglected by the Democratic side. It's certainly not been neglected by the Republican side because they've made the argument vocally that Democrats aren't doing enough to encourage exploration and development of domestic fossil fuels. So it's a pretty clear line between the parties. I think people who are paying attention, you know, kind of can see that issue on the table in front of them.
Was there a big boost to green companies for the stimulus package? Have there been many green jobs created, Craig?
I don't know the answer to that, and I'm not an expert in this issue. I do know that there's been a lot of pushback from Republicans on incentives for green energy because they regard them as wasteful, and I think the position of a lot of conservatives is that the economics aren't there for these alternative energies, and so we shouldn't be trying to subsidize them. That's the argument on that side, but I don't know what the numbers are.
Mm-hmm. We'll look at that at some point. Dave in Door County. Hi, Dave.
Good morning. Hi. Happy 4th of July.
To you as well.
Hopefully we have lots more to celebrate. Anyway, what I'd like to say is I think the biggest problem, I'm agnostic when it comes to political parties at this point, but I think the biggest problem that we have in terms of discussing this in a what I would call a more rational or measured tone is just that we've gotten to the point where change in terms of you know how we deal with the economic realities in this country we've come to a place where changes have to be made that have been essentially put on the back burner for decades, and just the very nature of change itself makes it difficult for people to deal with it. You know, emotions flare up. It seems to me that, well, and the comment that I made to your producer is that, you know, so to me it's sort of like drinking and driving. I mean, most people recognize when they're thinking straight that if you drink and drive, you know, eventually you're going to cause somebody some real problems. You're either going to get in huge legal problems, somebody's going to get hurt. And the sooner you stop drinking and driving, the sooner the danger ends.
What
same thing is true with the economy. The sooner they start doing something different and quit doing the things that are causing the problems with debt, not just government debt, but private debt, business debt, the sooner people can really have a solid reason to breathe easy. So I'll just leave it at that and
all right,
take my
Dave.
Comments off the air.
All right, thanks for the call.
Well, I'm not quite sure where the caller was coming from in terms of policy agenda, I mean,
right.
or what policies he was arguing for. I do think it's true that, you know, we do have some deferred problem solving here, and that's part of the problem. And the other big part of the problem that we've been alluding to is this kind of political stasis that we're in where people throw around the word polarization, but what's happened is that the parties have not only sorted themselves out ideologically to the point where there's no overlap, or virtually no common ground, no overlap between Republicans and Democrats, but the gap, the policy gap between the parties has gotten bigger and bigger. And, you know, there's a lot of debate in the among political scientists over whether that really reflects a growing gap in attitudes among Americans at the individual level, or whether it's just the political system and the way partisanship works now that you've got these kind of warring camps with a growing gap between them. So maybe America, it may not be the case that America is more polarized, but they may be being offered a more polarized choice, and it may be that the political elites are certainly more polarized, and so that it just becomes so difficult, as we see in Minnesota, as we've seen in Washington, and as we would be seeing in Wisconsin if we had divided government, to find any kind of common ground that's acceptable to the kind of base of both parties, the people that really supply the energy to these parties. So that's where we're at. I mean, it's a lot of people talk about 2012 as being an opportunity for the American public to kind of settle some of these longstanding arguments, but I'm a little skeptical of that because I don't see, I don't see 2012 as necessarily resolving this cosmic argument between right and left. For one reason, is that a lot of people aren't necessarily crazy about those alternatives, and they're really somewhere in between. They keep lurching back and forth from one side to the other because when one side goes into power, that they have concerns and problems, and they react against it.
Let's talk about Wisconsin for a moment. Do you think, I don't know if there has been good polling on this, but do you think that the Democrats stand a good chance of winning 3 Senate seats in Wisconsin in the recall, or does that not look like it's part of the picture?
Well, my sense is that everybody thinks they have a good chance of winning 2 Senate seats, and I think they, you know, there's some sense they have a pretty good chance of defending their state Senate seats. So the question is, where would the third pickup that they would need to flip the state Senate come from? And there's, you know, 2 or 3 Senate districts where it could come from. There's a little bit of argument over which one is the most likely, but generally the 2 Republican incumbents that are seen the 2 that are seen as the best shot for Democrats to defeat are Dan Kopenke and Hopper in the Oshkosh area. So if you give those to the Democratic column, you've got to pick up another one somewhere else, and that could be Sheila Harsdorf, it could be Luther Olson, it could be Alberta Darling, although Alberta Darling, I think, is seen within the political world as a little bit safer now because people think that she's going to be able to turn out her conservative base in the Republican suburbs and offset some of the opposition she has in the Milwaukee County part of her district. So, you know, I can't put odds on it. I think it's still a little bit of an uphill. I think it's still an uphill challenge for Democrats to net out 3. I think, you know, a certain number of things have to go right for them.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Marie in Bayview. Hi, Marie.
Hello. I have 2 separate points. And the first one is, if we were doing well in the 90s, when Clinton was in charge of the presidency, and he, and we were doing well, kind of balanced the budget and things like that, probably still had a huge deficit, but, you know, or huge debt, but he did balance the budget. Well, you know, why would Bush come along and start 2 wars and decrease taxes? That is what put us where we are.
Craig.
Well, that is certainly the case that Democrats make that a significant part of our current problems are that kind of legacy from the previous administration. Republicans, concede to some degree that Obama inherited a lot of problems and inherited a bad situation. Their argument is that he made it worse because that argument is heavily dependent on the notion that the stimulus was a failure in their eyes, although again that's debated, and B, they would argue that the health care law is kind of a ticking time bomb, along with the entitlements that were there, obviously, or that are not Obama's legacy, but that are just there as part of the system, as part of the structural problem. But they would argue that health care is a ticking time bomb and that there's all these embedded costs that are going to explode down the road. Again, these are arguments that are very difficult to settle on paper in the here and now. So that's kind of where we're at. I think any fair-minded person would say, yes, part of the problem that we have now is part of it's embedded in a long-term sense, and part of it, yes, is the consequence of decisions that were made during the previous administration, the cost of the wars, the cost of the tax changes. So that's all there. But as everybody knows, presidents are judged on present conditions once they've settled into office. And so that's the burden that Obama carries politically, is he has to make his case in this environment.
And don't you think that in terms of Afghanistan, this quite some time ago became Obama's war?
Well, yeah, and I'm not sure. I don't know if Afghanistan at the moment is a real drag on him politically. I'm not sure that it is, but it could be. And you're also starting to see Republican support waver. You're starting to see a Republican Party that looks a little bit less interventionist than it did under President Bush. And even Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, acknowledged to a room full of reporters the other day, and I was one of them, that he has members, Republicans in the Senate, whose instincts were maybe more non-interventionist, but under Bush, out of party loyalty, they lined up in support for his policies, and now they're less likely to do that under a Democratic president.
Craig Gilbert, our guest. It's All Things Political for this 4th of July. No better way for you to spend the 4th of July than talking about America now and America in the future, and that's what we do every Monday at 9. Craig is Washington Bureau Chief of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Our phone number, thanks, Marie, for your call. One line is open, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program, historian and author Lance Hertogen, who is chair of the Wisconsin Civil War Sesquicentennial Commission. From 1861 to 1865, Wisconsin sent over 91,000 men to fight and suffered over 12,000 casualties. There are many events in the Midwest and in Wisconsin marking the sesquicentennial. We'll learn more about those events and about the contribution of Wisconsin, the soldiers, and those on the home front. And that will be our number two. Craig Gilbert is with us now for All Things Political. We go to George from Arborvita. Hi, George.
Good morning. Yeah, for the last caller, I think if that caller would take time to read about appeasement in the Second World War, she'd better understand why we ended up in Iraq. For your bureau chief, let me give you a simple explanation of Ron Johnson. He's a businessman, and he understands government has to be run like a business or it's going to fail. Obama doesn't know anything about business. And that's why he's failing. He spent 2 years working a health care program when he should have been dealing with jobs. Not that government creates jobs, but government can get out of the way so jobs can be created. For the caller who's coughing and sputtering, tell him to open his garage door when he runs his car.
Craig.
how to respond to that last,
right.
last comment. But no, I mean, that's the argument. That is an argument. I mean, that, what the caller's words are, I mean, that's really an argument that Ron Johnson has been making. I mean, you can have a debate about whether government should be run like a business or not run like a business, or whether it's similar or different from a business. I mean, Ron Johnson made the comment to me when I was interviewing him that in the context of the debt ceiling, you know, if we were to have what he called a debt ceiling budget, which is we missed the deadline, we can't borrow any more money, so we suddenly don't have enough money to pay all of our obligations, and we have to decide, at least on a temporary basis, which ones we're going to pay and which ones we're not going to pay. This is the scenario that some people say would be catastrophic and that Ron Johnson is arguing would be not the worst thing in the world. And his comment was, at one point he said, you know, it's like a business losing 30%, losing a customer that represents 30% of that business's sales. Businesses do this all the time, so why shouldn't government be subject to the same situations and forces? And then I think somebody on the other side of that argument would argue, well, government is not like a business in some respects, and one respect would be if the U.S. government fails to pay its obligations, it's not just like a business failing to pay its obligations, but it could have all these ramifications in the credit markets and shake people's faith in our currency and in our ability to pay our obligations in a way that would lead to long-term rise in interest rates, short-term rise in interest rates that would be damaging to our currency, et cetera, et cetera. That's the debate. So, again, you can... Republicans tend to say government should operate more like a business, and Democrats tend to say, tend to emphasize the ways in which government is different from business.
Thanks, George. Nan in La Crosse. Hi, Nan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Happy Fourth.
You too.
And I guess I want to refute George's comments. He needs to go back to his civics class and realize what government is there for versus business. And also, going back to Marie's call, I'm in support of her comments that we never had a true sense of the cost of the Iraqi war. It was on all kinds of emergency funding, supplemental funding, et cetera. I just looked on the Internet the other day that it is projected to cost over $780-some billion since the start of that war. And it's... about double what we're paying for the Afghanistan war. And if we would have funded that properly with taxes or some kind of funding, that if the Republicans were true to their word and paying for things, then this we wouldn't have been in as dire consequences as we are now, I think, with this deficit and the debt. And then secondly, I guess I don't understand why more people aren't making the hedge fund managers and the corporate jet type things more of an example to embarrass the Republicans or each other, because both parties, I think, have utilized hedge fund managers, campaign donations. And the general public is sick of hearing about all the loopholes and those kind of hedge fund managers, you know, jetting off somewhere. I would love to see someone make more of the political points and embarrassing each other on that. I guess I'm just kind of sick of the whole game, too. So with that, I'll leave comments and reaction.
Thanks, Nan.
Well, I think you have heard some of what the caller is referring to in her last point, and you'll probably hear more of it. On the foreign policy, I think that's one reason why you're starting to see more skepticism within the Republican Party about these foreign interventions and on Libya, but also just antsiness about the timetables in Afghanistan, because you've got these, quote, fiscal hawks talking about reducing government spending, and obviously defense spending is a big part of the budget, and of course it's a fair point to say that this that the military interventions over the past decade were not paid for in the sense that we went out and found kind of offsetting spending cuts or raised taxes in order to account for the increased cost to the Pentagon of waging these wars. So you do have and I'll be writing a little bit more about this week, because I think we're going to have a vote on Libya in the United States Senate. You do have senators like Ron Johnson, who haven't really been that outspoken on foreign policy, but when they did talk about it during the campaign, tended to talk about it from a more, stay the course kind of Bush kind of rhetoric. Now talking about America kind of, reconsidering and, reevaluating and cutting its costs and finding more cost-effective ways to pursue our foreign policies.
Don in Portage, hi.
Good morning. I'd like to suggest that consider that these fabulous millionaires that we hear so much about aren't your mom and pop store owners on Main Street. They're more like lawyers and doctors or other money mongers that live in gated communities. And I think a big start that we could use to help ourselves with, if we go back and review our financial restructuring and break up these big banks, separate consumer from investment banks, and bring back usury laws, and to top that all off and go back and clean up all these exorbitant tax loopholes for corporate America. And I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Don.
Well, there is... on tax loopholes, there is some support in both parties for, and it's much easier to said than done, but for the support for the principle that the tax system should be simplified, that we should, quote, broaden the base by subjecting more activity to taxation, which is another word for closing tax loopholes, and then lowering rates in a way that, the only way it would probably happen politically is if it was revenue neutral, in the sense that it kind of netted out to the same amount of revenue as the current system, but that it didn't have all these carve-outs, that it didn't have all these subsidies, that it didn't have all these loopholes. The political problem with that is that these deductions, these exemptions, they not only include things like corporate jets, but they also include things like the home mortgage deduction and, the deduction for the state and local taxes you pay and the health care you get from your employer. So it is a tough issue politically to do this kind of massive overhaul of the tax system, but economists, this is one thing that probably economists across the stripe, you tend to hear from economists of all stripes making the argument that our tax system is really inefficient and has all these extra costs embedded in it because of all the carve-outs, because of the complexity. So there's people in both parties that are talking about kind of taking a huge whack at the tax code. And again, that whether that can happen, begin to happen before the 2012 election, whether it can occur under divided government, whether it can only occur under divided government, those are all sort of questions that we don't know the answer to yet.
Maybe somebody needs to resurrect Proxmire's Golden Fleece Awards and hammer home who's getting outrageous breaks.
That's part of the debate we're having right now, absolutely.
Jim in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. People need to act and refuse to fund politicians who refuse to elect politicians that fund needless wars. We have to do the work to nominate and elect positive people that will act in our interest.
All right. Thank you very much for your call, Jim. We go to Randy in Racine. Hi, Randy.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Listen, just as I'm listening to the conversation, and I hear a lot of emotion, but I'm not hearing a lot of facts discussed, and let me just throw a couple out that I wish your listeners would consider, and that is 52% of Americans pay no federal taxes. The top, the evil top 1% that we all talk about pay 38% of all income taxes. The top 2% pay half. So, I guess I think what I'd like to do is we're in serious trouble. Right now our debt is $45,000 per man, woman, and child in America, and our unfunded liability is close to $400,000. I think we got to take the words of Abraham Lincoln and put them in perspective, which is you can't help the poor by destroying the rich. And that's my comment.
Craig.
Well, again, this is part of the argument we're having right now. I mean, on the right, the argument is made that how can you say the wealthy aren't paying their fair share when obviously we have a progressive tax system and people at the high end are paying a disproportionate share of taxes. People on the left will argue that over the decades we've seen rising inequality in this country, and so the gap between rich and poor in terms of income and wealth is growing, is ever growing, and it's only exacerbated by the kinds of tax policies that Republicans advocate. That's part of, again, that's part of the debate we're having. I do think the 52% figure about people who don't pay federal income taxes doesn't include, unless I'm mistaken, doesn't include payroll taxes, which
right.
are taxes that everybody pays who earn wages. There's obviously a lot of people who pay payroll taxes only, and that's really their federal tax burden, not income taxes.
We need to end on that note. Craig, have fun at the fireworks.
Okay.
And thank you. Thanks. Thanks so much for joining us on the 4th. It was a great conversation. Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour. And thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production. And I'm heartened by all your calls on this holiday. Thanks for your calls, everybody. News ahead, and we'll return on the Ideas Network.